So now we come to the next exciting episode of The Word of the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So the word of the Buddha, the five components of existence, and the anatta doctrine. So we go to the foam story. First of all, the top of the anatta doctrine. Are you there?
No, the mirage.
The mirage? Are you sure that was just a mirage of yours? Okay. Oh, that's right. I remember that. So, after the mirage, that's the perception. Now, we have, suppose a person needing hardwood would take a chainsaw and enter a forest. There they would see the trunk of a large banana tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. They would cut it down at the root, cut it off at the crown, and unroll the coil. As they unroll the coil, they would not find even softwood, let alone hardwood. And a person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and without a base. For what basis could there be in the trunk of a banana tree? So, too, whatever kind of will there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect it and carefully investigate it, and as you investigate them, it appears to you to be void, empty, and hollow. For what underlying basis could there be in volition? Now, first of all, the usual simile is a person needing hardwood would take a handsaw or a two-handle saw and go into a forest. But in these days, I never see anybody taking a two-handle saw and go into a forest. They would get a chainsaw. So I've changed the simile slightly, but still keeping its meaning. But the point is here that that's what we take to be the will. We look at it, look very deeply into it, and we find there's nothing solid in it. There was the great, still alive, teacher, Bhante Gunaratana. Usually called Bhanteji. Getting old now. But he's one of the last of those group of monks, Venerable Narada, Venerable Kesari Dharmananda, all those Piyadasi, and this other one, Wimal, I forget his name now. But all these wonderful old monks. And they was like almost like a cream of Sri Lankan monks, you know, of that particular age. And they were tremendous monks. And I always remember, oh, what's his name now? Not Nyan. Anyway, the monk I should really remember, he was a very, this is a total anecdote, he was a wonderful monk, but he grew up with Indira Gandhi. She was a very close mate of hers. And he was also in the Congress Party. He was a youth Congress leader in India and also the All India table tennis champion. And then he decided to become a Trappist monk. And he was a Trappist monk for a while and he said, no, this doesn't make any sense to me. And so I remember that when he, maybe you can delete this or I'll turn it off quietly. When he decided to leave being a Trappist monk, they said, well, what do you want to do? He He said, I want to go off and become a Buddhist. He said, no, don't become a Buddhist. He said, at least become a Muslim, because we Muslims at least believe in God. You Buddhists don't. He's a very funny man, because also what happened, he was in the Brickfields Temple in Kuala Lumpur with Kasi Dharmananda Bantiji. This is not Bantiji, another monk, I'll remember his name in a moment. But into this temple, just one afternoon, they're having a cup of tea, discussing the Dharma, and this monk, he was just, and I appreciate him because he was really unconventional. But his methods worked. Because into the temple, there was a couple of American Christian evangelists came in to try and convert them all. Convert Bantaji, Venerable Narada, and all his Piyadasi, all his famous monks. And instead of wasting any time, this monk just took one look at them and shouted out, get out of here, you bloody fools. That's what he said. And it worked. They turned around straight away and left. It wasn't perhaps the most Buddhist of methods, but my goodness, it was effective. It was Bantaji. I can open this up now. It was Bantaji. Again, a little bit of innovation with these similes. He decided, much better simile, he's now in Washington, Virginia, West Virginia. And he was saying, instead of a banana tree, he called it an onion. He said the simile was that Will was like an onion. It goes on and on with an I in the middle. O-N-I-O-N. And when you investigate it, my goodness, it makes you cry. And there's nothing solid in it. So I thought that was really a neat wiggle out of them. Come on, go around. So that is the Will. It says you investigate it, it's just like they've called it banana tree. There's no solid core to it. Onion is much better, though. There, a magician would perform a trick at a crossroads. A person with good eyesight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and deceptive. For what truth could there be in a magical illusion? So whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, and deceptive. For what authenticity could there be in consciousness? It's called a magician's trick. So those are the five similes. The first one is just a lump of foam. The second one is just a plop of rain. The third one is a mirage. The fourth one is the onion or the banana tree, nothing solid in it. And the last one was the magician's trick, Maya. And that was a very powerful teaching. So that's exactly what the Buddha said. It's very challenging. And of course, you know, you don't want to lessen the effect that has on you, because it really undercuts a lot of how you've assumed this world to be. But especially with the Will, there's so much science evidence coming out now that the Will is nothing much to do with you, a person. One of those pieces of evidence was from, if you wish to look this up later on, Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T, who did some wonderful experiments on the Will and choice. A very simple experiment. You know, you decide to close your fist, open your fist. Close it, open it. Whenever you decide. In the other hand, you had a little button. When you decide to close your fist, you press a button. When you decide to open it, you press another button. So, taking into account reaction times, you know, he wanted to actually to see when you decide and when you act, what's the difference in time. And when you decide to when you're at, isn't something like about 0.3 of a second, 0.4 of a second. But what he also did, he put a little gizmo on the brain, which would be able to record when the brain decided to start the process of moving the fist, or moving, flexing the wrist, or flexing the fist. It's called the readiness potential. And it's such a simple experiment to do. He did it thousands of times. And proved conclusively that the brain lights up, the readiness potential starts first, something like about 0.4 of a second, then you decide, and then you move. In other words, what you assume to be the will, it's not. It's part of the process. The brain decides first, then this perception which you understand, or you take, you assume wrongly, to be the will, the starter of the action. By that time it's too late. And then you have the action. So what you perceive, what you assume to be your will, is not. By that time, the process has already begun. It's not the beginning of actions of body and speech. That's weird, but that's true. L-I-B-E-T. But he did further research to show, yes, there's not such a thing as free will. In other words, once you're aware of it, it's already happening. But there is what he called free won't. In other words, you can stop the action. So once it started, next moment I can interfere and stop. I can't do anything. All I can do is press the stop button. That is very important, because later on, if we get to it, when we have right effort, the effort which gets you into peace is called renunciation. Letting go, stopping, giving up, pressing the won't button. I will not take that glass of alcohol. I will not say that nasty thing to somebody. I will not interfere. That is called the won't button. Hee hee hee. Anyway, the Sangita 22:29. One who seeks pleasure in a body seeks only irritation. Okay, I'm going to more science. I love a bit of science every now and again. I'm not sure how on earth a scientist managed to do this experiment. But please excuse me, they did a brain scan of people having sex. Now, the sexual orgasm. And they found what lights up in your brain is the same centers as the pain. It was the pain parts of the brain light up when you're having sex. It's weird, isn't it? Because that was totally unexpected. It's not the pleasure centers, it's the pain centers. Now, what it is doesn't matter if it is pleasure or pain, the actual real raw feeling. But we have been totally conditioned through our cultures to consider that to be a pleasure. And I remember in the Buddha actually told Ananda, he said it's a perversion, it's a change of perception, not the right way of looking at things. Interesting. But anyway, anyone who seeks pleasure in the body seeks only irritation. One who seeks irritation is not freed from suffering. One who seeks gratification in experiences seeks only disappointment. One who seeks disappointment is not free from suffering. One who seeks reality and perception. I went to go and see Niagara Falls once. Went to see Niagara Falls in 1969. And this is no joke. This is true. You can check it on the internet. When I got there, it was turned off. There was no water flowing over. They were repairing Niagara Falls. That's weird. They diverted the water somewhere. So I went there, there's no water flowing. It wasn't a drought, they just basically just diverted it. So that was very disappointing. Or, I remember that for years, when I was in Thailand, eating frog on rice. You know, disgusting food. And then the first time I went home to England, to my mother's place, and did she cook me any chips, my French fries? No. And I couldn't ask. And because she thought, oh, you're a monk. You know, you're from Thailand. You must eat rice and curry. So you get making me rice and curry. Mom, I've had enough rice and curry. And the only time I got any chips was from a Thai man in London. All that craving and desire. And eventually, when I finally got, I mean, sometimes, you know, as a monk, you can get some, let's say, fish and chips or something. And you know what happens? You have it in your bowl, and then someone puts custard on top. Oh, they're those in the same bowl. And it's, but finally, after about 8 or 9 years, I managed, because I had to go to a funeral service, and coming back, there was no time to get back to the monastery in time for lunch. So Ajahn Chakro said, okay, you can get lunch on the way back. I can get real fish and chips in that newspaper hot with vinegar and just like I'd fantasized for about 9 years. And it's whatever your favorite food is, but 9 years and there it was. And by the time I started eating it, it was so disappointing because I had tummy ache afterwards. It was not just as I expected it to be. That's the trouble with if you delight in experiences, it's just so disappointing. It's not what you expect it to be. It's always less. So that's a lot of suffering, disappointment. I remember going over to New Zealand. Beautiful scenery. If you look in the photographs, no, exquisite lakes and mountains, and just it was just so natural. But in the photographs, you couldn't see the sandflies; they were too small. You know what sandflies? They keep biting you all the time. Yeah, you can put some of the repellent on because it's so hot; you sweat that all off, and then the sandflies come back. So you couldn't stand still. But they didn't mention that in the tourist brochure. So have you ever noticed that life is really disappointing sometimes? Anyway, except there's only one place which isn't disappointing, and that's Jhana Grove. Lives up to everything the tourist brochure says. Anyway, anyone who seeks reality, or seeks gratification and experience, seeks reality and perceptions, seeks only illusions. One who seeks for illusions, I say, is not free from suffering. One who seeks contentment in volition. In other words, you will enough, and then you find, now I've worked, that's all I want, now I've got it, now I can relax. Sometimes I see that, you read that, oh, all I want in life, I want some freedom, I just want to pay off my mortgage, I want to, what do I want to do in the world? I want to meet the love of my life. Then, that's all I want, that's all I want. I'd love to have that written down, that's all you want. And of course, as soon as you got that, I want something more. So that's, I lost it. So that's the problem with the will. You seek contentment in it, and you don't find it. One who seeks contentment in volition seeks only frustration. Have you got frustrated? Have you been frustrated in your meditation so far? Why? It says so here. You're seeking contentment in volition. Let go of volition, and then frustration goes. And lastly, one who seeks eternity in consciousness seeks only for the affliction of more rebirth. One who seeks for rebirth, I say, is not free from suffering. Why this laughter? Why this joy? I'm a big hypocrite here. No, the Buddha said this, but some of the things I don't like repeating. Why this laughter? Why this joy? When it's forever burning, shrouded all about in gloom, won't you look for the light? Look at this attention-demanding body. It does demand attention, doesn't it? Can you sit still, not move? And the body wants to move, wants to itch, wants to go somewhere, wants to do something. It always wants attention. A mass of irritations. Needing support. Prone to illness. With nothing stable or lasting. The body gets worn out, so fragile, an incubator for diseases. We all got lots of diseases in it, but you know, when you get a bit weak or something happens, then those diseases, they come forth. When life ends in death, this disappointing body dissolves. There are three warnings you've probably heard. This is classic Buddhism. Just gets you motivated to do something. But my friend, didn't you ever see a man or a woman 80 years of age or more, frail, sickly, struggling to walk even with a walking frame? They said just with a stick. But people don't walk with a stick, they walk with a walking frame. So just change it to modern. It keeps the original meaning, but just makes it a little bit more easy to understand. With many a complaint, strength gone, with false teeth, with white hair or wig. Or with a wig. They didn't have that in the original, but that's what people do these days. With wrinkled skin and blotched limbs and forgetful. My friend, I put the forgetful in there as well, because that's older people, they do get forgetful these days. And they keep repeating themselves. With false teeth, white hair, and blotched limbs, oh, and forgetful. And I added in that because... and forgetful, and I... My friend, didn't occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to old age, I'm not exempt from old age, let me now do good karma while I still can, by body, speech and mind. But my friend, didn't you ever see a man or a woman sick, moaning, gravely ill, bedridden, incontinent? You know what incontinent means? That means, you know, you just, you can't hold your dirty stuff which comes out of your bottoms. But my friend, didn't you ever see a man or woman incontinent? My friend, didn't it occur to you, an intelligent, mature person, I too am subject to illness. I'm not exempt from illness. Let me now do good karma while I still can by body, speech and mind. But my friend, didn't you ever see among human beings a dead man or woman in a coffin about to be cremated or buried? My friend, didn't occur to you, an intelligent, mature person, I too am subject to death. I'm not exempt from death. Let me now do good karma while I still can by body, speech and mind before I get to my coffin. It's called thinking outside the box. And... yeah. So samsara, this samsara is without a beginning. A first point is not found of beings roaming and wandering on, or blinded by delusion, addicted to wanting. Blinded by delusion, you think you're doing something really good or making something helpful, but you're deluded and addicted to wanting. Wanting this, wanting that, wanting something else. If it's not wanting food or money or experiences, it's wanting the spiritual materialism, and the wanting just goes on and on and on. But to actually to stop the wanting and be content. You don't need much to be content. You got food, you got lodgings, you know, you've got what else? You got clothes, medicines and karma sickness, we'll call the four requisites, the basic requisites of life. You have those. And for the next few days, you've got nothing to worry about at all. Nothing to do. So this is heaven. You can be content here. This samsara is without a beginning. Our first point is not found of beings roaming and wandering on, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. What do you think, which is more, the stream of tears that you have wept as you roamed and and wandered on through your many lives, weeping and wailing because of enjoying the disagreeable and not getting what you want? all that stream of tears, or the water in all the great oceans, which is greater? For a long time you've experienced grief through the death of a loved one, or of a dear friend, or the loss of reputation, the loss of wealth, some of it deserved, mostly not deserved. And you've experienced this weeping and wailing because of enduring despair and not getting what you want. All this, or the stream of tears that you have wept, the stream of tears that you have wept is more than the waters and all the great oceans. That is why the oceans are salty. Many tears. But this is actually all the round of rebirths. Thousands and thousands of rebirths. What do you think is more, the streams of blood that you have shed when you were beheaded, as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, this or the water and all the great oceans? For a long time you've been arrested as murderers, burglars and adulterers. And when you were beheaded, the stream of blood that you had shed is greater than the water in all the great oceans. For what reason? Because this samsara, round of rebirths, is without beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings who, blinded by delusion, addicted to wanting, are journeying through this round of rebirth and death. Even just one person wandering on through their many lives, blinded by delusion, addicted to wanting, would leave behind a stack of bones, a heap of bones, a mass of bones, as large as Mount Everest, if there was someone to collect them all. And what was collected would not perish. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. For such a long time you've experienced suffering, agony and disaster, and swelled the cemeteries with your bones from many lives. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all volitional formations, will. Enough to let go of the course of more rebirth. Enough to be liberated from samsara. Haven't you had enough yet? Yes. You don't want to be reborn again? No. So, sometimes when we only see the small picture, you know, we think, well, you know, just maybe this life is not that bad. But when it goes round and round and round so many times. And one lovely thing now is people are starting to get rebirth experiences or past life experiences through, through hypnosis, regression. And every now and again someone comes up with a real beautiful anecdote of their past life. And things which you can't find any other which way. And then they tell you this and you get a skilled person and they tell you what your name was and who you married, where it was. And there's even not one fellow. He's far from being a crazy person. He was a naval officer over here in Perth. And then Naval Reserve and he was actually, his brother had problems, you know, psychological problems. And he did realize that sometimes you go to these regressionists and they take you back into a previous life. And sometimes, you know, whether it's a real past life or not, the problem tends to solve itself when you actually find out the cause of it in the previous life. And so he did that. His brother had the problem, but before he'd get his brother to go through this regression, he decided he should do it himself, first of all, just to check it out. And if it was going to work, then he'd send his brother. But what was happening here in Perth, because he was in the Naval Reserve, they had this huge, terrorist operation. You know, just preparing in case there was a terrorist attack in Perth. And, you know, so it was really full on, and just with all those machine guns and stuff, and just hardly sleeping, because it was just a training exercise, but he had to do that. It's like a SWAT team. And at the end of the exercise, he just managed to squeeze in his appointment with the regressionist, and he said because he was exhausted, he said that's why he probably got into the hypnosis really easily. All his defenses were down. He was just so tired. And so he got into this past life where he recalled that he was in Fremantle Harbour over 100 years ago as a soldier, but not any soldier he could remember, because he was wearing a brown uniform. And later on, of course, and it got all the details, went to the library, the Batty Library here in Perth, and found photographs of them. And they were only a few of them. They were people who were hired by the British Army, poor people, to come to Australia to look after the convicts. Not a very nice job being a convict jailer, but do 3 years service and then you can get a grant of land for free. And he came from such a poor family in Ireland. They didn't have Northern or Southern Ireland then. And about the 11th of 15 children or something. So no hope, poverty, or the grind of poverty. So he decided, even though he said, you know, from that time that he hated the English, but, you know, he needed a job. So he did that, and he remembered where he met his wife in a pub in Fremantle. The name, it's, you know, was knew where the pub was, his wife's name, his name, and the grants of land which they got up in by Mount Barker, that's down the south. And he remembered everything. And of course, taking down all the names. And of course, he didn't believe a word of it, just fantasy. But when he went to the library and all those names came up, even the land, the title deed, exactly where he knew it would be, you know, that place, and there was his name on it. And even he went down apparently to see the plot of land, but he said he knows where he died and he knows where his grave is, but he hasn't gone to see that yet. That would be really creepy. He looks at the headstone and said, "That's me under there." But, you know, he's totally convinced now. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes if you remember all these things, it's amazing just what other explanation can you give? Round and round and round. So until eventually we've been there, done that, had enough. Anyway, so the noble truth, that's the first noble truth of suffering. The origin of suffering, why? Now this is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this wanting which leads to rebirth, accompanied by enjoyment and desire, seeking delight now here, now there, that is wanting related to the five senses, wanting to be and wanting not to be. Even the wanting not to be, wanting to exterminate yourself, you just get reborn again. That's not how to end this cycle. And where does this wandering arise and become established? Wherever in this world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there this wanting arises and becomes established. Sight, sound, smells, taste, tangibles, mind objects, that's the objects of the six senses. That's where the wanting arises and becomes established. When you see something you like, but even the six consciousnesses themselves and experience of the six consciousnesses, even if it's not something pleasurable, still just to experience itself, we want to experience, even if it's unpleasant. We'd rather have unpleasant experience than no experience at all, because no experience is scary. You will find that out. When you get into meditation, things start to vanish. But it's very pleasant. But I'd rather have the pleasant experience, which I know. So the unpleasant experience I know than the blissful experience, which I haven't experienced before. There was a classic story. There was this, he was like a hippie guru called Ram Dass, many, many years ago. And, you know, long haired, beads and stuff, you know, when being a hippie and being going to India, you know, was the cool thing to do. And mostly they, you know, went and took lots of drugs. But, you know, not very spiritual. But this guy, you know, he came back to the United States because he was actually a Harvard psychologist. So, you know, he had a lot of credibility from Harvard. And so anyway, he became a hippie and a guru, And then one of his disciples, the father was really sick in hospital, in lots of pain, and apparently the palliative care was not helping very much. A lot of pain, and so the daughter invited her guru, this really long-haired guy with beads and stuff, into the hospital room to maybe help, you know, her father. And the father took one look at this guy and said, "Keep this freak away from me." Because it looked a bit weird. And this was in the 60s or 70s. So anyway, that she was talking to her father, and he was just standing at the end of the bed, and he decides to give him a foot massage. You know, without being asked. And giving a foot massage, he obviously now had learned something in India. And when he was giving him the foot massage, the father just interrupted his daughter, took one look at him, "Get away from my feet." Because the pain had gone away. Weird, but he was pain-free. But he'd rather have the pain and be in his comfort, in his knowledge zone, than have his pain taken away by something which totally challenged his worldview. And remember that story. So often, that's what happens. People rather have the pain and be comfortable. They know what's going on, than have their everything which they know, which they believe in, challenged. That's why that sometimes desire doesn't just come from seeking for pleasure. Sometimes the wanting comes, even just wanting to be conscious, even conscious of unpleasant things. Experience of the six senses is agreeable. Perceiving sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and mind objects. Just to actually experience, even if it's nice, if it's good stuff, but if it's unpleasant stuff, at least it's something. Will in regard to sound, smells, taste, touch, mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable, and their wanting arises and becomes established. Willing, we want to will. Something to strive towards. It's a goal to set. There is a pleasure in willing. Striving, struggling, even if it's painful, doesn't get you anywhere. The journey, struggling, pushing, there's a pleasure in that. That's why it's so hard to give up. Of course, there's pain, but at least we're alive. Wanting of sight, sound, smells, even wanting itself is a pleasure. Wanting to want. Thinking of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, mind, objects is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises, it becomes established. This is the fantasies which people have. Because in fantasy land, you don't need to be a loser. In fantasy land, you're always a winner. Your team always wins the World Cup soccer. In your fantasy land, you always find the most beautiful partner in the world. And they always do, not like real husbands or real wives, they always do exactly what you want when you want them. In fantasy land, you can imagine winning the lottery. So you never have to work ever again. In fantasy. Can I tell you one of my fantasies which I had once? In my fantasies, it's actually a dream fantasy. I was fast asleep, but I didn't want to wake up. I remembered everything, really good. Because I was having a psychic battle with a Hindu guru. We were flying through the air, zapping one another, and zapping, and I missed this zap, and I zapped him back. But it was my fantasy. So guess who won? So, that's fantasy land. You can create whatever you want in fantasy land. That's why it's pleasurable. But after a while, you get so tired and a waste of time. Fantasizing about sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touches. And that is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. You delight in stuff. dependent origination of all phenomena. On seeing a sight, the same with the other six senses, if you want it, if it's pleasing, you try to get rid of it if it's unpleasing. Either way, you make business for yourself. You abide with mindfulness and wisdom of the five sense body unestablished. With a limited mind, you do not understand as it actually is the liberation of the mind and liberation by wisdom, wherein those deceiving and oppressive states cease without remainder. They deceive you, they promise they're going to get you somewhere, but they're so oppressive, having to think and do stuff. Engaged as you are in favouring and opposing, I want this, I don't like that. Whatever experience you have, whether pleasant or painful or neutral, you delight in that experience, welcome it, remain holding on to it. As you do so, delight arises in you. Now, delight in existence is a fuel. You want more. With fuel as a condition, states of existence develop. With states of existence as a condition, rebirth. With rebirth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, negativity, and distress come to be. Such is the origin of the whole mass of suffering. That is part of dependent origination. From fuel as condition, states of existence happen. You create the homes in which you will live. You create the situation in which you get reborn into. Good example is virtual reality, where it's like a fantasy, but much closer to real life, where you create your future. Even heaven realms and hell realms, they exist, but they're nothing like you see in the temple drawings. You create the heaven you feel you deserve. So, if you went to a heaven, would you have white clothes and little donuts over your head? That's just so last millennia. You know, you'd have, I don't know, just really nice clothing, like, you know, from the French salons or somewhere. You wouldn't just, you know, have ambrosia to eat. You know, you'd have noodles or dumplings or whatever it is you really like. So, and music? Harps? Can't we have like an electric guitar? Get a bit of rock and roll up in there? Or whatever you like. But you make heaven to suit you. And the same with the hell realms. You make hell to suit you. For however long you feel you need to repent and suffer. And the wonderful thing is you don't need to repent at all. The doors of hell, if you make the hell to suit yourself, or you think is appropriate, you make it, and it's a crazy thing to do. You can forgive at any time. The doors of hell are always open. And you feel you don't deserve, or you can't. It's not right to walk out, to forgive yourself, to learn. It's open. Wonderful, please remember that. If ever you do go to a hell realm just because you feel really bad about something you did, then let it go. You can walk out any time. Forgive. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn. You grow. So that's actually, we create states of existence. And in this human realm, it's only a certain, it's like we've only got a certain way of arranging this existence, but in this existence, we can make sort of so much difference to our life. We can make it a hell realm, even in this life, or we can make it a wonderful life. You make your existences. So that's where we say the fuel, the wanting, is the fuel which creates the worlds in which we live. That's where we take rebirth into. The karma. The only reason I say this is because you've got two little words there, sanditika and samparayika. And you know the word sanditika because we chant that morning and evening. Suvakkato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayika. And what sanditiko means, it doesn't mean in this present moment, it means in this life. To experience in this life. With the five senses as the cause, the source and the basis, the culprit being the five senses wanting something. Presidents quarrel with prime ministers, politicians with each other, priests with imams, businessmen. That's not what they said in the original, but it's taking what the original said and actually putting it into a modern words. Businessmen with householders, monks with nuns. You have to put them in there as well because, you know, sometimes you think, Ajahn Brahm, come on, don't sort of put yourself outside of this. You know, this is our life. The nuns, monks, parents quarrel with each other and with their children, sibling with sibling and friend with friend. And here in their quarrels, wars and disputes, they attack each other with abuse, weapons or lawsuits. Modern ways, you don't attack each other with clubs and swords. That's what the original says. Use lawsuits these days. Whereby they incur death, injury or loss. Now this too is a danger in the case of the five senses, a massive suffering in this life. The cause being simply the five senses. When you want, there's never enough to go around. And when there is enough to go around, you deserve more. And it's unfair. That's what we think. Again, with the five senses as the cause, people steal, commit fraud, sleep with each other's partners, commit domestic violence, sexually abuse their children. And when they are caught, they're imprisoned and ruined. Again, I try to, the problems of our modern world. Now, this too is a danger in the case of the five senses, a massive suffering in this very life. The cause being simply the five senses. And those are the causes and the effects in this life. And again, with the five senses as the cause, the source and the basis, the culprit being simply the five senses, people indulge in misconduct of body, speech, and mind. Having done so after death, they reappear in states of misery in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now, in this is a danger in the case of the five senses, a massive suffering in this life to come. Having the five senses as cause, its source and its basis, the cause being simply the five senses. You will not find a spot in the world, nor in the sky, nor in the ocean, nor inside a mountain cave, where you will be free from the results of karma. So can you be free from the results of karma? Yes. Not in a cave or at a spot in the world. In a spot in wisdom, inside your own heart, and knowledge forgive, you can let go of this stuff. We find that out later on. Karma as volition. Volition is karma, I say, for having willed you out by body, speech, or mind. In other words, if it's an accident, real accident, you don't know what you're doing, and you step on a snail, is that bad karma? You had no intention to do that. So it's not bad karma. You have to will it to make it bad karma. The will, intention. That's the heart of karma. Is it good karma or bad karma? That is the quality of the motivation, whether it's from a noble motive or from a bad motive. So, and what is the diversity of karma? There's karma to be experienced in hell, in animal realm, or in the ghost realm, or in the human realm, and there is karma to be experienced in the deva world. What is the result of karma? The result of karma, threefold, to be experienced in this life and next life and some subsequent life. Inheritance of deeds. Being are the owners of their karma, the heirs of their karma. They have karma as their origin, karma as their property, karma as their resort. Whatever karma they do, good or bad, they are its heirs. Does that mean you're stuffed? Bad karma? What are you going to do? Karma gives you the ingredients of your meal. It's how you put those ingredients together. The meal, the ingredients, sorry, the rice, the curry, whatever it is you're making, that's past karma. How you put those things together in this life, that's called present karma. And I think you all know the ingredients you have to cook with, if they're the best ingredients, it doesn't mean you get the most tasty meal. Some people, they put so much care and energy and skill into cooking, And sometimes their ingredients are very, very, very poor, and they make an amazing meal. So remember, the ingredients you have to work with in this life, you know, your skill base, your health, you know, your family, where you come from, and all the other things which happen to you in life, that's only half of karma. It's what you do with it. That's also really important. In fact, even more important. How you put the ingredients of your life together. There comes a time when the great oceans dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. Global warming predicted. There comes a time, when the Himalayas, the king of the mountains, burns up and perishes and no longer exists. But, should I say, there is no making an end of suffering for those being roaming through rebirth and death, blinded by delusion, addicted to wanting. There comes a time when the planet Earth burns up and turns into cosmic dust spreading through the universe. I added that bit, but the Buddha said the time when it burns up. And any sort of astrophysicists know that's going to happen. This planet, this solar system, this sun, it expands into a red giant, and it gets so big it will totally take up the orbit of Mars and I think Venus. It won't be as big as the orbit of planet Earth, but Earth will be vaporized. Everything, including Jhana Grove, including all the monuments to Donald Trump and to everybody, even the great pyramids and everything which we noticed, any mementos of your existence on this planet Earth, any sort of very fancy gravestones, it would all disappear. And you and your memory and the memory of all of your family and friends will be cosmic dust. Flying through the universe. You know, it's really cool, some of this science. That's actually true. That the only way that, if you, for example, if you asked the atoms in your body, their history, where they came from, then many of your atoms are high elements, like, you know, like the iron inside of you. You probably know this. That has been through at least, is it two or three? But at least two supernova. Twice in their existence since the Big Bang. Since the Big Bang. They were part of a star which exploded so violently. And that spread those little atoms through this universe. And some of them collected together through gravity. They collected into another star, and that also had the same fate, exploding. And then some of those little cosmic dust particles were caught in the gravitational field of our sun and around our planet Earth, and now they're in your body. That's the only place where the elements such as iron can come from. You literally are. And it's true. This is not hippie stuff. You are stardust. Some more cosmic than others. But that's actually true. And that's not in heaven. Anyway. Okay, planet Earth ties up. What's the next one? The noble truth of cessation of suffering. Okay, we've got a little bit on here. Are there any questions on that? So far, cosmic dust. Yeah. So don't just complain to the caretakers that people aren't sweeping the dust off the floor. That could have been some ancestor of yours a long time ago. Cosmic dust. Ooh. Anyway, noble truth of cessation of suffering. This is the noble truth of cessation of suffering. Okay, that's the bad news. This is the good news. Suffering can end. Yay! It is the remainderless I always stress that word. It's called aseza. And aseza means nothing left. The remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting. The wanting relating to the five senses, wanting for existence, wanting not to be. It ceases without remainder. The giving up, relinquishing of it, freedom from it, never letting it settle enough to grow. That's from the famous Dhammacakka, turning the wheel of the Dhamma. And I pause on this one because I just pause on just that one paragraph. I remember giving a talk about that, which was my most popular talk on YouTube ever, Four Ways of Letting Go. And you can see it here. Giving up, relinquishing freedom, never letting it settle enough to grow. The giving up of it, that is called chaga. Giving. But it's not any type of giving. Some people give donations, they want tax receipts. Or else, they're not going to give anymore. Or they give and they want a big sign up. This is Delatruz Hall. Just to show how generous you are. And that's not giving. That's giving, expecting something back in return. Or sometimes you help someone. And they never said thank you. I really worked hard. They never said thank you. They got no gratitude. That is not why we give. We give just for the joy of giving, not expecting anything back in return. It's the first type of letting go. You don't want anything. You just want to give and share. Now look, how many times have you, you know, you've helped someone and you're anonymous. They don't know who the heck you are, but you've helped them. And those are so inspiring. It really is selfless. And that letting go, there's nothing in it for you. You just want to give. It's one of those most joyful things in life, to share, to give to others. And especially, they've got no idea who you were. And that, the story of Nuns Monastery. Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, you're going to go there on Friday. You know how that started? That started so many years ago. Just want to do something for women in Buddhism. And what do? You get, first thing you do, open up a bank account. And just hope that somebody, at least you've got a place for people to put donations in. And getting nowhere. I think $5,000 or $6,000 or something, you can't buy much for that. You can't even, buy a cardboard box to put on the corner of the street where a nun can live. So, what do? I just told people, and then one of the moments which changed everything was when this gentleman came to Bodhinyana Monastery in front of the kitchen building, and he said, "I hear you're building a monastery for women." I said, "Yeah, not yet, we're still collecting money." He said, "Yeah, I know that. A day or two ago, my wife gave birth to my first child. And it was a girl. And I want to do something in honor of the birth of my first child." He said, "I'm a Buddhist," he said. "But," he said, "and I don't know if my daughter would ever want to become a Buddhist nun. But I want her to have the chance, the opportunity. If she wants to be one, I want it to be there for her. So can I make a donation for your nuns monastery?" So, "Yeah, sure." And so it was a check. So I can't receive cash, but checks you can receive because it's not in my name. I can't take it and abuse it and put it in my slush fund. Oh, I haven't got a slush fund. My dad has slush funds. So he gave me a check. And I looked at make sure it was written out. My God, $250,000. $250,000. And he left. And don't know his name. I always thought I'd love to contact him and actually tell him how we've gone. But he disappeared, didn't want any receipts, gave that money and vanished, never to be seen again. Wow, that was weird. Didn't want anything, just wanted to give. And that's how, so this day, sometimes, look, when I look back upon these things, that maybe that was a day for someone trying to sort of help out a really good cause. Because I can't think of why would not anyone just at least call or visit and say, how's it going? They just vanish, gone. Ooh. So that is real giving, and that's inspiring when that happens. Or just as I said, you know, the monks, we can't give money. We can give a lot of time and energy. They're putting the floor up there for you, middle of the night. That's wonderful. So all that giving, that's part of the end of suffering. Relinquishing. Meditation. I haven't said this yet, but this is what Ajahn Chah kept on teaching me. We meditate to let go of things. We don't meditate to get more things. Especially attainments and ego. How long can you meditate, Jasmine? that's nothing. I can meditate twice as long as that. How many retreats have you done? That's nothing. How many jhanas have you got? How many psychic powers have you got? Have you got more powers, Ajahn Brahm, than Ajahn Bhamani? Let's have a psychic contest. That is something terribly wrong. We don't meditate to get things or to, you know, to show off. We meditate to disappear, to let go of things. So when you're meditating, what are you meditating here for? To get more attainments, like more degrees, more qualifications, you know, more stuff. Should at the end of the retreat we give you a little medal, first jhana medal, second jhana medal, third jhana. Sometimes people do that, give you certificates, but that's not right. You meditate to let go, to have less stuff. And that means we become more free. That's letting go and giving up the freedom from it. Oh, that freedom from it, I maybe say, oh no, I can say it now quickly. Are you happy to be here? Really? We'd like to go somewhere else? Well, you want a cup of tea? You want something to eat? You know, when you're meditating, you can sometimes ask yourself, am I happy to be here or do I want to be somewhere else? Do I want to be enlightened? Do I want to be in jhana? Do I want to be able to watch my breaths? Where do you want to be? If it's somewhere else, you're not free. In a prison, a prison is any place you don't want to be. Freedom, even if it's in jail. If you want to be there, you're free. Freedom is being content to be here. When you're meditating, it's not the best meditation. It's a bit hot, cold, achy. Yeah, I'm not in a deep meditation yet, but I'm just happy just to be here. Not wanting anything in the whole world. Contentment. You're free. And people can be in, I caught myself, I was in Japan at a conference, and they put me up in a 6-star hotel. 6-star hotel in Japan, and had all this stuff in it, and I was scared. It had a jacuzzi, you know, had all these buttons on it. No one ever explained to me what a jacuzzi is. You press one button, and of course, you know, I didn't dare to try the jacuzzi, but I tried the toilet. Press this button and that button. Many of you have done that. You know, I'm a monk, you know, just a bit of a kid sometimes. So, you know, you stood off and pressed all the buttons to see how far it would go. Have you done that? Yeah, come on. But then after a while, I got so bored. What am I doing in this hotel? I want to be out in the forest. But, you know, because it's a conference, they wouldn't let you go anywhere. Because, you know, you had to be there. Because then when they wanted you, they come and collect you. Conferences. And so I was right being in a prison. And I thought, I don't want to be here. I want to be free. And he goes, Ajahn Brahm, you've lost it. When you're there, you have to be there. Then you're free. Or like in Indonesia. It wasn't Jakarta. Where was it? It was some other place. I think, yeah, probably was Jakarta. Anyway, a big line of people signing buku and taking photograph. Signing book, smile, signing book, smile, signing book, smile. For 2 hours! I never became a monk for that. And after 1 hour of that, I said, this is crazy. I don't want to be here. And then I caught myself suffering. I couldn't escape anyway. You know what Handaka is like. He won't let me escape. So I was stuck there. So I thought, well, might as well change my attitude. Happy to be here. When I was happy to be here, it was so easy. Signing books, smile, made people really happy. You know, shared a bit of good energy there and smiling. You know, your own personal book signed. I can always remember this Muslim girl. You know, she was young, and I didn't realize, you know, hijab. I didn't realize they could say things like this. She came up to me, and when she, you know, she's obviously one of my fans, because as soon as I signed her book, she put her hand, oh shit, he's signing my book. Oh shit. It's perfect English. But I don't know if she's supposed to say that. But everyone, very, very cute, because she's a human being, don't care what religion or race you are or whatever. I'm just excited. So it's wonderful. When you're happy to be here, you have wonderful experiences, and time goes very quickly. You're not in prison anymore. So freedom is wanting to be here, wherever here happens to be. So those are the four ways of letting go, the start of the third noble truth. And now, of course, is the time to let you go. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.